In his introduction, Bent Shainer said quite rightly that the International Literature Prize has become one of the most famous literary prizes in Germany over the years. The only reason that this prize exists is that there are a whole host of publishing houses in Germany that carry out translations of international literature, and in particular, Eins, which is based in Munich. So I'm delighted to introduce Inge Holzheiser, who's sitting in the audience here. I really had to say that before we started off. Where's Inge? Michael Kruger was taking a look. So we've got a Munich publisher triumvirate up here. That's a good thing. Now, those of you who heard the reading before by Ivan Vladislavich and Thomas Bruckner, maybe you remember this description of that one particular day in the life of the narrator Neville Lister, and he meets the photographer Saul Auerbach, and two images come into being. In the literary context, and then all of a sudden, you take a look around the real world and you discover these photos. They're almost exactly the same. That has something to do with the particular genesis of the book Double Negative, because just like the book that we heard about first today, The Story of My Teeth, it's part of an exhibition project. And it wasn't published exactly in this format, but in a slightly different kind of format. So can you tell us a little bit about the original format for publication, please?
Sure. Well, the book came about, I guess, around 2005, 2006, when David Goldblatt was putting together a selection of his photographs of Johannesburg. His well-known photographer has been taking pictures since the late 40s and with a massive archive of work. And he decided to choose the best of his Johannesburg work for a publication. So it was conceived of initially as a book. He asked me whether I would write something for this catalog. I think looking for a catalog essay or some kind of text like that. I had worked with him before, and so I think he thought I would produce something similar. And it happened that I was in the early stages of planning a novel, and I didn't want to put that aside in order to write a critical piece about his photography, which I admire very deeply. And so I asked him if he would mind if I wrote a piece of fiction, neglecting to tell him that I actually had a novel in mind. So he assumed that I was going to write a relatively short text and it would be consumable within the usual parameters of the catalogue text. So that was really the impetus. He then gave me a preliminary selection of the works that he planned to put into the book to use as reference material. And I used those, I wrote with those in mind. Mm-hmm. I can show some of those if you like.
Absolutely.
These are just little, very small photocopies, actually, which were just really meant to prompt my memory about some of the works and give me atmospheres and so on for the book. And
yeah. Go on. Ich füge nur im Deutschen hinzu.
Let me just add in German. David Goldblatt is the great documentary photographer of South Africa. There's one passage in Ivan Vladislavich's book where he says there are two motifs, people and buildings.
Yeah, I think that's Goldblatt's great strength as a photographer, is showing you people in their places. Right. A lot. They're usually photographers who can do both, who are good at portrait photography or good at photographing spaces or places. But Goldblatt's particular genius, I think, is that he shows you people in the places they inhabit and creates a kind of extraordinary dynamic between the two. So how the people have been shaped by the places they're in and how they've made these places.
Absolutely.
So So anyway, he gave me a set of these very tiny little pictures. And what happens, I think, when you're working with visual material as a writer, you don't want to end up as a mere illustrator.
No.
So I was constantly keeping these at a distance and then sometimes referring to them and then sometimes putting them away and not wanting to look at them because I didn't want to end up simply describing the photographs. I decided at some point that I would try and that the photographs that Auerbach takes in the book would be reminiscent of Goldblatt's photographs, but they wouldn't describe particular photographs. So I wanted to capture something about the atmosphere of a Goldblatt picture. And I wrote the novel, described the two pictures which we heard in the reading. And it was only when I went back to the images and looked at them properly afterwards that I discovered I had described one of the images very closely.
This one, we can take the picture from the catalog.
Yeah. So
this is the lady referred as Mrs. Ditton,
right,
in the book.
Yes, yeah, she's called Mrs. Ditton in the book. She's unnamed in David's.
Sorry?
She was just out of the picture.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Thomas.
Perhaps you should press the focus button. She turns to disappear.
That's better. Yeah.
That's the ghost of Mrs. Ditton.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was a kind of amazing lesson for me in how the unconscious mind or the creative mind works, because I had truly not intended to describe a particular photograph.
Haben Sie früher schon über Fotografie?
Did you actually already write about photography before that in the past?
No, I'd worked with photographers before, but I've never written a critical piece on photography. I've written a little bit of critical work in sort of architecture and urban theory, but I'd never written a critical essay on photography. But I had worked with three or four other photographers, not quite in this way, but producing work that could supplement a catalog. So not actually dealing with their work, but sometimes dealing with the issues raised by the work or dealing with the same spaces.
Wir sehen, Sie haben ja gerade gesagt.
You see how the subconscious works. You see this older woman in her large armchair. And there's that kind of cupboard behind her, but how on earth did you manage to leave out the bird?
I left out the bird because I wasn't trying to describe the photograph.
Yeah.
When I looked at the photograph afterwards, I thought to myself, if I had seen the bird, I would have written the bird into the novel. But because I wasn't trying to do that, particular details had stuck with me, like the detail of the cabinet, for instance, had surfaced in my fictional recreation. I think the way that the chair is described in the novel, with the clenched fists, is quite a lot like the chair that you see. But you know, the bird and the birdcage, a lot of people who've looked at the picture also don't notice the birdcage on top of the cabinet. That's the one element that really amazes me that it didn't surface in my mind is that. And the other element, which is quite a cruel satirical element, is the comparison between her and this jug in the cabinet. I don't think you can see it very clearly there, but there's a Toby jug, which is one of those English jugs with a face, and it's quite astonishingly like the woman. So it's interesting because I guess the image constructed itself in a way that drew it very closely to Goldblatt. The other image, the Veronica image, there isn't an analogous picture, but I think that you could find elements of that description which are similar to Goldblatt's work, but there isn't one picture that jumps out as a photograph of a woman and two children, for instance. But this one sneaked up on me, yeah.
Ich schiebe jetzt mal.
I'm going to impose the following question on you. How did Goldblatt respond to this, actually? He commissioned a catalogue text and got an entire novel in return. And we're going to continue with this issue later as well. We're going to talk about details, but there's one thing we really have to address, and that's the name of the photographer. The alias of David Goldblatt in the book, Saul Auerbach. The name Auerbach, of course, reminds us of Erich Auerbach. Born here in 1882, right in this part of Berlin, the Tiergarten. He went to the French gymnasium here. He was a librarian in the Prussian State Library and one of the great novelists of his era. He fled the Israelis, went to Istanbul and studied European philology and published his masterpiece, Mimesis, there. And it's a book without one single footnote, by the way. But it is a gigantic footnote to European history, one might say. Well, I think this is important, though, to say this in the context of the images as well. When he was in exile, Auerbach didn't have a library. There wasn't the right kind of library in Istanbul, so he wrote this amazing book without any references. It was only the later editions that actually had footnotes added to them. But Auerbach himself, and that is really very striking, I don't know if you're familiar with this, there's letters that he wrote, correspondence with Walter Benjamin, where he tried to get some extra footnotes from Germany up to 1933 to make Mimesis more scholarly. And if you haven't read Mimesis, I can only recommend reading it. Now, you clearly have read Mimesis. What's the importance of Erich Auerbach for you? Because you've named one of your protagonists after him.
Yeah, well, I mean, I obviously wanted the reference to Auerbach, to Erich Auerbach. It wasn't that I wanted to point to any particular parallel between a character in the book and Auerbach, but there's a kind of field of reference in the book that concerns Benjamin and Auerbach and Adorno and that set of thinkers who were very important to broadly left-minded intellectuals and artists in the 1980s, which is the period when the early 80s when the section of the book is set. So. And I know Mimesis, and that's obviously the work that's there as a kind of backdrop to the reflections on representation in the novel. But it's not, it's a kind of general cultural reference. And you wanted me to ask just David Goldblatt's response was very generous. Would you like to pursue something else before we get there, or no?
No. When it would later on about the a project which came after.
Okay.
That you know the.
Yeah.
But I do want to know what Goldblatt said about your book. Do please tell us. I would like to know.
He was actually very generous about it and very excited about it. The context is that David has worked with writers before. So, in fact, he's always been more comfortable working with writers than working with other artists. He produced a wonderful book called On the Mines in the 1970s with Nadine Gordimer, for instance. And he's often, in interviews, when he talks about the influences on his photography, he more often than not refers to literary influences. So he's a person with a real, he's very well read and he has a real interest in writing. So he was taken aback, you know, he was surprised because he was flattered. I mean, he got a real bargain out of, he expected a catalog essay, he got a novel. I think that's pretty good going. But he also had, there was a practical kind of issue which came up, which is how do you publish such a thing? How do you publish a novel and a photo book together? So it presented a real dilemma. And fortunately, David has the status in the publishing world to find a solution, and so the two projects were initially we planned to try and fit them into a single book, so it would be a compromise format that would maybe be a large format paperback that would be a little bit bigger than a novel but a bit smaller than a photo book, And we simply couldn't find a way of doing it. Mm. And then the designer, Sint van Houten, came up with the idea of publishing the two-volume set.
Did you get paid as you have written an essay or a novel?
Well, I didn't get paid at all.
Wie hätten Sie denn bezahlt, Michael?
How would you have paid him, Michael Krüger? I'd have given him a bit extra, I must say. But he, of course, like any good publisher, he doesn't say how much. Anyway. Ivan Vladislavich is famous for the way in which he tells his stories, almost as if in passing, one might say. And here, while hearing a story about photography, we also learn about the history of South Africa, including its political dimension. The image you have here, actually there's two images that are important here. A parallel image of a black woman with two kids, a third child who died because she heated her hut with a heating device that emitted poisonous gases, because that was the only kind of heating that she had. So you can see the harsh social reality, the pitiful situation, and perhaps that is the reason why the author avoided this excessively clear metaphor. There's this white woman almost in a golden cage with the bird as if in a cage. There's three sections to the book. The first is set in the 80s when the photo's taken at the apex of apartheid, when it was in full swing. The second part is shortly after the end of the apartheid regime. And the third is in the present. The comparison with the time machine is often used in the book. And Thomas Buchner, if we look at the number of people you've written, Abdulrazak Gurna, Helaman Habila, and so on and so forth, you translated a whole host of different writers, very different authors with very different values, very different linguistic styles. In Ivan Vladislavich's book, again, you've dealt with three different kinds of language because they're languages from three different time eras. How do you translate time?
Nächste Frage.
Next question, please.
Kann ich schlecht sagen?
It's hard to say because for me, translating is a process that happens in several different stages. Like with every translator, basically, you start off with your first reading and then finally you end up with the manuscript, which you hand over to your publishing house in the hope of your small salary. And you're very happy to have given birth to the thing finally, but there's various different phases of writing and rewriting and reworking. And of course, you creep right under the skin of the book and into the figures. And the more often you do it, you develop, if you're lucky, a fairly precise sense of what has to happen. If you're able to put that into practice linguistically, it's quite another kettle of fish, but it is possible. The same with translating different times, different eras, of course. With your heart and your gut, and you have in your mind everywhere a conception of the time in which each section of this book is happening, the first, second, and third parts. And at the same time, you know about the kind of expressions and the kind of unpleasant expressions that were also found in that era. So there's also something of cultural history in it as well. A question to Ivan as well. Has the use of language really changed before, during, and after apartheid?
Certainly. I mean, I think if you look at the field of language in the apartheid years, we had two official languages, which were English and Afrikaans, the favored languages of the white population, and the local African languages were marginalized and you know, sectioned off into particular radio stations, into into particular schools, and so they were kept out of the public space very much. And certainly, they were kept out of a common public space.
Mm.
And I think one of the great things that's happened in the post-apartheid period is that you hear more languages, you hear more accents, you hear more regional ways of speaking in the common public discourse.
Mm.
And there are subtle ways in which the use of the language is changing. So expressions that would have been regarded as, you know, not part of standard English are becoming more, you hear them more often. You hear different pronunciations under that effect. Yeah.
Was auch sehr, weil wir über die gesprochene Sprache sprechen.
As we're talking about spoken language, something I think that's very striking in your translation is the fact that right from the beginning you have the feeling that Neville Lister is really telling you the story yourself. It's very close to the flow of spoken language. Well, that's because when I translate, I read out loud. Sometimes I walk up and down as I do it. Because Ivan's language also has a certain rhythm to it. It's relatively contemplative. There's a lot of other authors who are much more hectic in their rhythm. Everything's much speedier. Whereas it's very carefully weighed up, very precise, very measured. And so I walk up and down in my room, and then when you've got the rhythm right, you can write the sentence down. I'd be interested as well to know the reception of this book in South Africa. It's been described as a book with a particular European colouring to it, one might almost say. Was that the case, really, or was it read as a really specifically South African book?
I certainly don't recall that any of the reviewers spoke about that European layering, although it's clearly there. It's there in the cultural references and intellectual framework of the narrator. But that's, you know, I think true to character, this kind of character with this kind of education would have these cultural references. The fact that they're European, to me anyway, doesn't make them less South African. I think our cultural frameworks are very often hybrid frameworks. They're very broad. I certainly don't feel that they need to be limited to things that are within our own space, within our regional space or continental space. But it's not something that any reviewers have spoken about.
Ich meine, wenn man nur
If you just look at the German version and the German references, the reference to Günter Eich, for example, those aren't names that people normally know in South Africa, I'm presuming, not even amongst émigrés, I'm guessing. And so I thought, actually, when I was reading it, and let me add in a parenthesis at this moment, it is a wonderful book, a really wonderful book. Did you already say that at the beginning? That's all right then. But feel free, you are a member of the jury after all. When I was reading it, sometimes I suddenly thought, maybe this is much more a book for us to explain South Africa to us. And not really so much a South African book per se, if you see what I mean. We had very few relatively young authors from South Africa who found readers here, and there was that bifurcation there as well. On the one hand, there's this African level, the authentic narrative, and then on the other hand, this highly reflected, theoretically ambitious narrative mode with a whole host of references. References to German intellectual history, ranging from Benjamin to goodness only knows where. And so I had the feeling that the author wrote this book for me, not for the South Africans so much.
This author wrote the book for you as well. I would suggest that if your expectations are that this is not a South African book because it doesn't tick the usual boxes that African fiction should tick, then I'm very pleased with that reception, because that's exactly what I don't want, is to write the typical book.
Yes.
What boxes would that be?
Well, that for exotism. Instance, that an African book, for instance, shouldn't be full of references to the intellectual history of the rest of the world. The fact that it speaks to you doesn't preclude the fact that it's written primarily for an South African and African readership, who also references those texts, those artworks, yes, that the music. So, I don't like the idea of writing to explain my society to another audience. Because I do think that a lot of African fiction has fallen into that trap. And certainly a lot of the fiction written during the apartheid years was trying to explain South Africa to a foreign readership. And that's certainly not something that I'm interested in. But I would like people in other countries to get the book in the same way that I expect my local readership to get the book.
Yes.
Aber es gibt trotzdem etwas.
But nonetheless, there is something that allows us to understand the book through the process that's unfolded in South Africa over the last 30, 40 years. Thomas Bruckner pointed out that one of the attributes of the book is its slow pace, its rich wealth of details. And the book describes processes. It's about this man, Neville Lister, growing up, and these three stations he passes through, these three staging posts. He creates a kind of oeuvre. He has something to say as well and can communicate somehow with the world. And it seemed to me that vis-a-vis South Africa, the book is sending me the message that we're in a process. We'll do it nice and slowly. The world wants to see results as quickly as possible, invisible ones, but that doesn't exist, specifically not in literature. But on the other side, in a way, I'd say you're right. In a non-German novel, in no other non-German novel did I ever find a reference to Gunter Eich. I mean, hardly anybody here's ever heard of him except for us old chaps. And there, all of a sudden, and I find that interesting. It intrigued me that the book can be read on two different levels. On one level, which is a very precise history of the consciousness of a revolution, and yet it's also an intellectual narrative. I think that's something that we need to bear in mind and really highlight, to really become aware of the high quality of the book. That's what I find so fascinating about it. Yes, and the story is absolutely fascinating as well, isn't it? One last step. You and David Goldblatt started off in a very unusual way, and then there was a next step to the project as well. The photographer that you invented, Neville Lister, and Saul Auerbach, who was sort of copied on from David Goldblatt, then returned back into reality because Neville Lister took photos. How exactly did that work?
Well, David was approached actually around about the time the book appeared. He was approached by Broomberg and Shanderin, who are an artist duo who curate exhibitions and produce books. And they were putting together an exhibition called Alias for Poland. And the idea of the exhibition was that they would pair photographers and writers. The writer would invent a character who was a photographer, And then the photographer would have to inhabit that persona and go out and make the photographs. So David asked me if I would work with him on that project. And we spoke it through, and the thought that we'd already invented a photographer, whereas most of the duos were starting from scratch. We had already invented a photographer who had taken a whole body of work and had exhibitions and so on. And so we decided that David would inhabit the persona of Lister, of the young man who he mentors in the novel. And I presented David with the dead letters, which are referred to in the
second part of the book.
I can actually show some of those, actually. So in the novel, the character Neville Lister inherits a set of letters which have never been posted. At the time of the novel, he's never opened them, and so he doesn't know what's in them. But they're letters that have been returned to sender because the addresses were incomplete or indecipherable. And so I actually gave David some of the letters. One doesn't really need to be able to see them very clearly, but this is an outmoded technology that used to be called the aerogram. I don't know if anyone remembers those.
Oh, yes.
So I gave David these various letters and forms. This is a prison release form, for instance. And he then went in the persona of Lister, and he went looking for the addresses that these letters had been posted to. And so he took some of these pictures. This one, for instance, was taken in Göttingen.
Yes.
Outside the train station. Yeah. This was another version, but it wasn't actually used in the book. This was taken in South Africa in a town called Langsburg. That's working quite well.
Denn Neville Lister hat als eine Serie.
Neville Lister photographed walls and fences as a series.
Der einzige Fehler.
The only mistake you actually made, if you asked me, was that you guessed that there's a ghost street in Göttingen.
Nein, diese Briefe.
That was a poor guess. So, this is what happened with these images, is that they were the letters and Neville Lister's photographs were then shown on an exhibition. I don't have great pictures of the exhibition, but this gives you some idea. Perhaps there's one of the whole room that shows the gallery. Yeah, that shows the gallery space. Mm-hmm. So the letters and the photographs were shown together. And then the text of the letters and the photographs were taken up in my next book of fiction. So the project sort of grew out of a documentary book into a novel, back into the world, and then back into another work of fiction. So this is, I don't know if we've got the book here.
This is absolute, but this is rare, if not unique. What do you make of it? What kind of, welche Art von...
What kind of insights did you glean from that?
From it.
Die Erkenntnis, die er gezogen.
Well, he realized that in the future he'd be called Ivan Borges Vladislavich. And you'll be publishing him again, will you, at Hansa?
So that was that project. I'm not going to say what I learned from it. It's not my role to do that.
You
okay.
Don't have to.
Okay. Meine Damen und Herren, wenn...
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't been entirely convinced yet that this is a fascinating book from a quite unique project, then let me quote right at the very end. Did you call who... won the 2013 ILP and wrote the introduction to the book. And it says there that the book uses a language which as a sparkling and fine-grained as a silver gelatine print. It is like a silver gelatine print in literary form. Thank you very much, Thomas Bruckner, for having developed the images for us in German as well. Thank you to everybody.